The call came unexpectedly in May 1970. Within months, I went from being a young Justice Department lawyer to White House counsel for President Nixon. What began as a dream job would evolve into a nightmare of criminality that would ultimately bring down a presidency. My journey through the corridors of power reveals how easily ambition can blind us to moral compromise. My first meeting with Nixon was surprisingly cordial. Despite my nervousness, I accepted his offer, while Mitchell, my former boss, cautioned me about White House politics. "Haldeman is the president's right and left hands," he explained. "He does for the president what the president isn't any good at doing himself." Little did I know how prophetic those words would become. My first ethical test came quickly when Nixon wanted an IRS investigation of a magazine that had satirized Vice President Agnew. When I expressed reservations, Murray Chotiner blungly informed me, "If Richard Nixon thinks it's necessary, you'd better think it's necessary. If you don't, he'll find someone who does." I crossed an ethical line I would never uncross, setting a pattern that would define my White House tenure. The White House machinery operated with military precision under Haldeman's tickler system, a relentless tracking mechanism for every assignment. Missing deadlines triggered escalating responses, from secretary calls to harsh reprimands, with each incident recorded on Haldeman's reputation-defining scorecard. Power struggles pervaded the administration. Ehrlichman systematically worked to wrest control of domestic agencies from Attorney General Mitchell, using a calculated approach of study, cooperation, critique, and finally power transfer to his office. In January 1971, I received a pivotal assignment that would later illuminate the roots of Nixon's downfall. Investigating Larry O'Brien, Democratic National Committee chairman, and his Howard Hughes connections. This routine-seeming task would eventually spawn the Watergate scandal. Haldeman's focus on campaign intelligence grew urgent. He emphasized that nothing has higher priority than the president's re-election and dismissed existing intelligence as worthless. Nixon's team advocated aggressive campaign tactics, determined to outmaneuver the Democrats. When Liddy inquired about campaign intelligence funding, I casually mentioned maybe $500,000. He later returned with a bandaged hand. He'd burned himself over a candle to prove his strength to recruits. This disturbing display should have been my warning sign. In Mitchell's office, Liddy presented his gemstone intelligence plans using color-coded charts. His million-dollar proposal included kidnapping radical leaders, using prostitutes to compromise Democratic officials, and sabotaging the Democratic convention. Mitchell, visibly offended, merely suggested Liddy go back to your drawing board. After a second meeting with similar surveillance plans, I spoke up. "I don't think this kind of conversation should go on in the Attorney General's office." I immediately told Haldeman, "This stuff is incredible, unnecessary, and very unwise." He agreed and advised me to cut ties with Liddy. While relieved to exit the campaign intelligence business, I hadn't shown particular courage. I'd repeatedly stopped short of crossing a line that separated me from the first team, men who trampled rules, believing their power protected them. On June 18, 1972, I returned from Manila to news that five men had been caught breaking into Democratic National Committee headquarters at Watergate. Among them was James McCord, security coordinator for the committee to re-elect the president, and one burglar carried a check from Howard Hunt. The next day, a panicked Jeb Magruder called. "This is all that dumb fucking Liddy's fault. He never told us he was using McCord." When Liddy arrived, he was disheveled and worried, a stark contrast to his usual commanding presence. He admitted to a previous break-in to plant a transmitter and photograph documents, returning only because the device failed. Liddy's revelation that Gordon Strachan might know of the operation suggested Haldeman and possibly the president were aware. Before leaving, Liddy offered ominously, "If somebody wants to shoot me on a street corner, I'm prepared to have that done." Later, Strachan informed me he'd destroyed all operation-related documents, including wiretap logs, assuring me Bob's files are clean. Though the White House publicly dismissed the break-in, we worked frantically behind the scenes. My role evolved from fact-finder to idea man to cover-up manager. While initially clear of criminal involvement, I soon became instrumental in obstructing justice and arranging hush money payments. I maintained a facade of being merely counsel while actively interfering with the investigation. When the FBI planned to interview a witness about Hunt, I sent Fielding to England to coach her against testifying about another break-in. I also coordinated payments through Herb Kalmbach, who became our first fundraiser. By late June 1972, my influence peaked. The cover-up succeeded politically. Internal polls showed Watergate hadn't dented Nixon's popularity, with most voters indifferent. After September's first Watergate indictments, Nixon summoned me to the Oval Office. He praised my skillful handling of emerging leaks. But when discussion turned to enemies, his mood soured. "We're getting a few shots. It'll be over. Don't worry. I wouldn't want to be on the other side right now." In November, days after Nixon's re-election, Howard Hunt began making escalating demands for hush money, setting deadlines for resolution on the liquidation of everything. My stomach dropped. Watergate was only going to worsen. My mental health crumbled as I studied obstruction of justice laws and accepted our criminal status. Managing daily crises while running an expanding office took its toll. At home, I doubled my scotch intake and withdrew socially, straining my new marriage. By March 1973, I spent hours behind closed doors contemplating imprisonment. Like Raskolnikov, I grew paranoid and self-destructive, almost wanting capture to end the deception. When Hunt demanded $122,000 where he'd reveal seamy things, I finally refused to be his messenger. Confiding in Dick Moore about Hunt's extortion, I expressed my despair over the endless cover-up. Moore called it like a cancer, a metaphor that crystallized the need to end this corruption. In the Oval Office, I warned of a cancer within, close to the presidency, growing through blackmail and perjury. The president's quick familiarity with the Cuban committee payments and his assurance that we could find $1 million for blackmail were telling. Judge Sirica's reading of McCord's letter exposed the perjury scheme. At Camp David, my wife's simple question about refusing to write a false report sparked clarity. During a woods walk, I resolved never to lie under oath, even for the president. Nixon fired me in 10 words on national television. After hearing my account of presidential discussions about hush money and clemency, my lawyer Charlie Schaefer declared, "The president is a goddamn criminal." Blind ambition destroyed both my career and a presidency. When power becomes the goal rather than the means, when loyalty supersedes integrity, we lose our moral compass and ourselves.